Hi, everyone. My name's Anne Marie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anne Marie.
And as he said, my home group is Big Book Thumpers, and we meet on Monday night, 8 o'clock at Lindale Baptist Church in Richmond. So if anyone's around that area, please come visit us. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 1996. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come up here. It was an experience. We were late, but it was not my fault this time. It really wasn't. Usually I am. I'm always the late one. But tonight it wasn't me. So I'm here to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I guess by this time you all can tell I'm not from these neck of the woods. I come from a small town in Scotland, and I have one brother and a mom and dad. And both my parents growing up were active alcoholics. And I'm glad to say both my parents today are in this fellowship and have been for a long time, since I was a kid. Basically, my dad's been in the fellowship nearly 30 years, and my mom's got over 20, so that's been it's an awesome experience. And I have a brother, and he's still out there adding to his story, so hopefully one day he'll find the rooms. The town I grew up in was a small town, lots and lots of bars, one in every corner. And I remember when I moved here, you all have churches in every corner, and I'm like, where's the bars? Because we had a few churches, but they were kind of hidden away, and there was bars, you know, you could walk. There was probably a population of 10,000, and there had to be at least 30, 40 bars. And we all grew up, each of us having a bar. You always knew, if you were looking for someone, where their bar was. And that's, you know, so I grew up in a culture where alcohol was the norm, to be honest. And I'm not saying, I actually went home this year, and I used to think that everyone over there was either drunks or recovering drunks, because that was the only people I knew. But I don't think that's the case. I think there is a lot of normal people there too. So the town that I grew up in is a military town, an American military town. That's why I'm here. So it was like a little seaside party town. So that's the environment I grew up in. My mom and dad, growing up with active drunks, we were always kind of everyone knew us as the neighborhood, the drunks as kids kind of deal. So there was a lot of shame and secrets growing up. You know, you thought no one knew, and you didn't want to tell anyone what was going on inside the house, but of course everyone did know. My purpose then was to stay the heck out of the house. I mean, I'd stay at girlfriends' houses, I'd stay anywhere I could rather than be at home. Didn't want to be there. And I always wanted to be someone else or be somewhere else. Never wanted to be in the environment I was in. And that went on way in adulthood. The grass was always greener on the other side. So up until the age, you know, I used to think I was an alcoholic because my mom and dad were alcoholics, and that's what I knew. And today I know I'm an alcoholic because I like to drink. I mean, that was the bottom line. When I started drinking, I liked the effect. But growing up, I hated alcohol. I really, truly believed I'd be the last person that ever drank or certainly turned into an alcoholic, because I knew what it done. I'd seen it in my family. I'd seen it in other people's families around me. The one thing I didn't always know what I wanted to be, but the one thing I knew I didn't want to be was like them. And I strived pretty much all through my early teenage years at school to be the best I could, because I knew my passport out of this small town environment was a good education. And that's pretty much what I've done. But I hear it up here all the time, always felt like I was kind of living a double life, because I had this face where everything was okay, and, you know, I went to school, and I was like a chameleon, I'd hang out with, you know, the swarthy people, but I really didn't ever feel like I fitted with them, because they all had normal parents. I mean, I hung out with the doctor's kids, the dentist kids, and it was always kind of, they knew what, like, my home life was, so I always grew up feeling that, very secretive, very, would not let you in one little bit. My first drink was in Paris, and I was young, I was on vacation with my aunt, who's the next thing to a nun. She just lives in the church, and my cousin, who was in the training to be a priest at the time, so that's who I was on vacation with, and we went there, and I think I was about 13, and they served wine with all the food, and, you know, kids drink it too, so I had a glass, and it was the most awesome feeling. I remember that night, bouncing off the walls in the hotel, giggling, waking up during the night, thirsty, and you couldn't drink the tap water, and getting up the next morning and not feeling real good. But that was it, you know. That was the one and only experience I had with drink. Went through, as I said, teenage life, studied at school, tried to keep away from the chaos as much as possible at home. Absolutely hated my mother. But this time my dad had gotten the fellowship, but he was too busy helping drunks. And he was gone a whole lot. He was in the Navy, so he was gone a whole lot at the time. But I do remember all these drunks coming in my house. The house was always full of drunks. My dad would 12-step guys, and I'd come in from school, and they'd be sitting. So I had this image of drunks with these old men sitting in front of my fire, taking up my dad's time kind of deal. And so I didn't really have a high opinion, even though he wasn't drinking anymore. And I always remember feeling that if I ever told him what my mom was doing while he was away at sea, he would drink again. So I always had that feeling that I had to protect him and keep her secrets. So I grew up pretty much hating my mother. And the only thing, as I said, I knew is I didn't want to be like her. So I think I was 15, 16, and over there, that's quite old to start drinking, I mean, because everyone is kind of, the age over there is 18, but pretty much everyone is drinking at 15, 16, going out to the bars. And I was going to the bars, I just wasn't drinking. And then I remember one night I was standing in a dance and felt shy and just out of place, and someone gave me a half a shandy, which is half lager, half lemonade. And I remember that feeling. And I remember the thought that went through my head was, this is why my mom does it. I just got that understanding as to why she drank all the time. And from that point, it was on. I mean, I drank from that point onwards to get drunk every single time. For me, there was no, there wasn't any social, there wasn't any, like, you know, social drinking or build up to becoming a drunk. I pretty much became a drunk from that point. Now, I did not start drinking every single day or anything else. It would be on weekends. I still worked hard at school during the week, and then weekends I partied. So at the age of 18, I achieved what I'd set out to do, and that was I got the grades and everything I needed to go to university up in Glasgow. So, you know, I was escaping the small town. I was going up there. And I had all these, I kind of had all these dreams. I mean, the one thing I knew is I was never getting married, wasn't having kids. I'd be nobody's secretary. So I wouldn't learn to type or anything, because it was just this thing. I wasn't, you know, I was going to be like my mom. So went to college and just started drinking constantly. I mean, I was in this big city now. there was no one there. I stayed with my aunt, but I mean, I don't mean she didn't care, but it was like, you know, I had freedom to do what I wanted. And I remember, like, starting every single evening going to student union, and in college over there, they have this place where they sell subsidized booze. So I mean, it was right on. I mean, it was in the college, plus they sold it cheap. So I mean, it was always, I remember always thinking, okay, statistics or the bar. And I mean, of course, the bar always won. So I started drinking basically on a daily basis at that time, doing things that I woke up ashamed of in the morning and not want to go back. So I would have to drink some in order to go face people, things I had done and things I had said the night before, the day before. So after probably 6 months, you know, all those dreams and ambitions that I'd had my whole teenage life basically went down the toilet. My grades were, of course, I mean, I wasn't doing anything, so I was just partying. And over there, they actually pay you. I mean, when I think of the opportunities, because they pay, you don't pay for higher education, and they actually gave me money to go to college. So I mean, I didn't have to work. I was like getting this free education, getting money, which paid for my booze. I mean, life was good. You know, if I could have maintained, I could have done this for years. But of course, I didn't know that at the time. So within 6-7 months, I seen what was happening, but I still didn't think it was anything to do with the booze. I mean, that wasn't even a thought. It was just like, you know, I don't know that this is for me, but I had made such a big deal, that grandiosity, that I was going to be all these things, that I was so full of pride that I couldn't let him know what was going on. So probably 10 months at college, and it's kind of a year deal over there, it's not really like semesters, I knew I was either going to have to reset the whole year or get kicked out of college because I had flunked, and I wasn't going to tell anyone. So meanwhile, I had been dating a sailor, and he drank like me, we partied, so it seemed like a really good idea. We talked one night, hey, let's get married, because he was moving away, and I'm like, you know, to me, that was the easiest way, because now I could leave college with my head held high because I was going to get married. It wasn't like because I was flunking. I mean, that was my thinking. I mean, so it was, you know, the solution of what would work for me today. There was never any long-term thought when I started drinking, like consequences or, you know, how this is going to be in 6 months or a year. It was just like, okay, this is going to get me, you know, the heat off me. So I remember we went in, and by this time, it's funny, my mom, you know, and it was a solution that got away from her, got away from the whole deal, and just at that time, my mom came in the fellowship. But I remember sitting with my parents and saying, hey, I'm getting married, and they're looking at me like, you know, because this relationship had been going on for maybe 9 months, and it was on again, off again. I mean, there was more chaos, and as I said, we were just drinking buddies, we were young. And they're like, you know, this is forever. And I'm like, yeah, that's, you know, that's good, that's fine. And we went to my priest, and, you know, the funny thing was is my priest ended up being in this fellowship too, but he wasn't at the time. So he's like, yeah, that's what you want to do. There was no religious training or anything else. And, you know, he kind of made an amends to me for that later on down the line. But so it was all good, and this big white wedding was planned, and I have a girlfriend who actually lives here now and is in the fellowship with me, which is awesome. But she was my drinking buddy and all that back there too. And I remember the night before the wedding, both of us went out, and we were drunk at our heads. We were going up to my future in-laws to stay there for the wedding, and I remember telling her, I don't want to do this. This is the biggest mistake, and nobody would listen to me. They're just like, oh, it's just nerves. So we went in the bars and told everyone I was getting married in the morning, so everyone's, you know, buying us drinks. And next morning, woke up to get married, feeling, of course, you know, hungover. And I remember telling my dad, I don't want to do this. And he's like, it's all paid for now, you're doing it. I'm like, okay. So that was got married. I was only 19 and a half at that point, you know. So by the age of 18 to 19 and a half, my whole life had just spiraled downwards. So we moved to a little Navy housing place in Rosyth, which is the east of Scotland. And my experience with that is the men go away, the women go party. So, and then I seen some women pushing strollers, so that seemed like the right next thing to do, is have a baby. And that's what, you know, so that was the next step. And I mean, you know, it's nothing I'm proud of, but I mean, during that pregnancy, I couldn't stop drinking. I drank. Thank God, I mean, she's fine. We've got our issues, but I mean, I don't think it's anything to do with that. But, you know, I just couldn't stop drinking. And I still was going out partying. I mean, I'm 7 months pregnant, and I'm still out there in the nightclubs partying. So that was for the next few years. He was gone for 6 months at a time. And I would just have myself a good time. I was there. As soon as I had a drink, I had to go party. I was not a house drinker. I mean, I would start in the house with no intention of going out. But as soon as I had a few drinks in me, I was on the phone trying to find someone to party with, you know. And so there's many a night I left my kid with strangers, you know, a friend of a friend of a friend, so that I could get in party. It really, you know, it really didn't matter. And after a couple of years of this, it was just total chaos. And, you know, I laugh today because my dad has been making living amends. He made a lot of living amends to me because I would leave him. He'd come and move all my stuff from the east coast to the west coast of Scotland, you know, and then a month later I was going back and, you know, he'd move all my stuff back to the east coast of Scotland, and that's kind of the way this relationship went for the next few years. And finally, it fell apart, and I've moved back home with my mom and dad. And basically they were babysitters, you know, they babysat, and I continued partying, and I got my own place. And but this time I've never really worked. I mean, all these dreams and all these ambitions I had, I'd never held a job. And I got a job in a bar, which was very good. And so I was able to. And it was funny because the bar was like my grandpa's bar. I mean, my dad's bar. It's like this bar had been there. The same people owned it for 100 years. So, you know, everybody knew. It was just like, you know, that's Mick's daughter, that's Mick's granddaughter. And it was always one for you and one for me. And we could, I don't know what like it is over here, but, I mean, we could drink on the job. So it's perfect. And I remember by the end of the night, I'd have one, you know, trying to count the money. And as soon as we finished there, we were always on to the next place. And this went on for, as I said, this went on again for a couple of years. And I remember, but this time I'm 25, my life is just, this is it. You know, my weekends have now grown from Thursday through Monday. You know, and on a Monday, it's never again. And, you know, that's the delusion of you, how you forget how bad it is. Because on the Monday, it would be like I'd be hungover and horrible, and I was never going to drink again. But the Tuesday, I'd forgotten a little bit. By the Wednesday, last weekend was not that bad. And by the Thursday, the anticipation of the next drunk was kicked in again. And so this went on. And I remember I was around 25, divorced with a kid on my own. And I was tired. I was physically tired. I was just tired. I had no dreams. I didn't know where my life was going. And I met an American sailor. And we didn't really, the local girls didn't really date Americans. But, you know, I don't know what to say, I was desperate. That just sounds very bad. But it was like I wanted something different. And this guy was, you know, he's not one of us. And he had all these dreams, like he wanted the house, the picket fence, the dog, the cat, you know. And to me, I'm like, okay, well, I don't have any. That sounds good. I'll just, you know, do it, you know. Yours sounds good. And so for the next year while we were dating over there and engaged, I was able to kind of tober it down just a little. I wasn't drinking as much. And when he was on duty, then I'd go out partying. But when I was out with him, I was able to not, you know, put on that other mask. And I remember the day, basically, I hit the States and I was just me again. It was like, I remember he says to me, "You deserved an Oscar." And, I mean, that's where I was. I was like, I was whatever you wanted me to be to get what I wanted, the manipulation. So during this time, as I said, my drinking had got really, really, really bad, and I was able to calm it down just a little. Moved out here, and of course, next steps to have another kid, you know, because that's what you do. And again, you know, I come here and the loneliness was awful. At least over there I was kind of, I wasn't unique because everyone I knew was like me, basically. And there was a lot, as I said, growing up in my family, but this time there was a lot of AA people in my house. And, you know, it's funny, just like on a Saturday night, my dad would have all these guys over after the meeting for a poker game. And I'd have to walk through them all when I came in drunk. And they'd all put the cards down and just sit there and look at me. And I just looked. I mean, I was so mad. And then I'd hear them all burst out laughing. And then occasionally they'd meet me in the town and go, "So you ready to join us?" And I had no idea I was an alcoholic. I mean, as in, I knew I drank a lot, but I knew I liked it. And that was like, you know, I've heard here, it was my solution. It was all the other things that were screwed up. That was my relief, and I truly believe that's what made me feel okay. That was my whole life. I mean, I didn't do anything without drinking. So when I moved here, and of course, I moved into this middle-class, normal America, and these people were not like me, or I wasn't like them. And you know, I remember going to the park with my kids, and I'd call my mom, and I'm like, all these people are on Prozac or something, because they were all happy. And I just knew that wasn't me. I didn't feel that. And I had never done things with my kids, or took them places, or done things. I mean, we kind of just survived. And over here, it was all this happy family stuff. Oh, that's what I've seen, of course. And I knew no one, and I think you all can probably understand me tonight, but my accent, I had no self-confidence. You know, I'd go into a store and nobody would understand a word I was saying, and I'd kick my six-year-old and get her to talk for me. I didn't drive. I'd failed my driving test quite a few times. So when I came here, I didn't drive. So, I mean, and you know you can't live here and not drive. So by a week, I was here a week, and I'm like, oh my God, what have you done? And but this time I'm 7 months pregnant, and I remember going for my driving test, and it's just a sideline, but I went, you can go here like every day until they pass you, whereas where I come from, it takes a few months in between to get your, you know, to get another appointment. And I just kept going to this woman, and finally she just passed me. I think she's like, oh my God, I'm not going to get in the car with her again. So I had a driver's license, but the fear, but this time I was just engulfed by fear all the time. I really didn't leave the house a whole lot unless I had to. And if I drove, I had to have, like, if it was 2 miles down the road, if there was road work in the lane that I was supposed to be in, I couldn't move. I just was full of fear, and I would just sit there, and finally someone would feel sorry for me and let me in. I wouldn't go on the highway. So I was pretty much a recluse in the house by this time. And all I lived for those first few years here was to get back to Scotland. All year I'd just save up. I'd save up to go back there and party. And the minute the plane hit down on the runway, and I remember the last time I was over there, you know, I get to my mom's house, and, you know, of course I'm jet-lagged and everything else, and they're like, just wait one night, don't go out tonight, wait till, I'm fine, I'm gone. And I'd stay there 6 weeks and just make their life hell, come in, not come in, puke, whatever it was I'd done. But, you know, the awesome thing is for all the times that they used to come over and leave literature, like the 12 and 12 and stuff like that, and I used to think it was for my brother-in-law because I knew he was a drunk. But they never once tried to make me, they just sat back and let me run my course, and I guess I see today that that's the only thing they could have done. But I am sure it broke their heart, because the last time they came, which was, well, the last time before I got sober, it was a week before I actually got sober. I remember my brother came too, and they'd seen me maybe 9 months, 10 months before that, and they looked at me and they're like, what's happened? Because I basically, the last year before I got sober, I really stopped taking care of myself, brushing my teeth, showering. I mean, these were, you know, I'd do it on occasion, sweatpants, hair tied back, I got rushed into the hospital because of my liver, I was in there for days with ulcers. So pretty much for the last year, I was just physically, mentally, spiritually, I mean, the whole nine yards, just falling apart. And I remember I called my dad and that, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And it was funny because they'd just left a week before, you know, but it just got, I wanted help, but I couldn't ask. And it was like, my in-laws and all that, my husband at that time would just tell people I was depressed, I was homesick. And that was the excuse why I never showed up for anything, because I just didn't go anywhere. I didn't go to family functions, I didn't show up for nothing. If I went to see my kids at school, I'd have to have something in my system. I just couldn't function without something in my system that last year especially. You know, and when I came over here, of course I went to the doctor, you know, the depression and all this stuff. So I was on some medication, and I really thought that was my problem. I thought that the medication that I was on, was making me insane, because I felt so insane. The only thing I could describe it was like voices in my head, and I just wanted to turn them off. And I used to say it was like the good angel and the bad angel, because they'd be sitting talking to each other, and I was kind of in the middle, and I'm thinking if I could just take my head off and get some peace. And I'd be driving down the street, and there was one tree in particular, and I just had this urge all the time just to pull the wheel, and I just didn't want to go on. So when the doctor finally looked at me, and he actually called me back in his office. He left me a message, he said, because, I mean, the ulcers, the enzyme, liver, I mean, it was all, like, ticking in his head. He called me and he says, come into my office, I want to see you. And he just busted me wide open. I know this is what you're doing, I know all this. And I'm like, but no one knows, I can't tell anyone. And he's just looking at me like, no one knows that you don't brush your hair or anything else, and nobody's noticed these things. And I said, but I can't tell anyone. He said, well, either you do, or I am, but either way, you're going to need treatment tonight. And I did go up to, actually went up to Tucker's, and you know, I was really good at manipulating people. I could put on that little housewife, that little Scottish housewife, and, you know, I'm not like that. And, you know, I basically manipulated my way out there that night to come back in the morning. And it was Memorial Weekend in 96. And I manipulated to come back in the morning. And I did go back, and that night I sat up the whole night just any medicine I had in the house, just swallowing that, you know, drinking. And I went back the next day, and I was, again, I put on this act, this little woman. She was so, God love her, but she was like, I've never seen anyone like you being so remorseful. So she just thought, well, maybe I'm not, because I was so nice and, you know, I wasn't angry or anything. I was so ashamed. And she let me leave. And I remember going home thinking, oh, my God, I've got nothing. What am I going to do? And I just knew I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. But I also knew that I didn't want to quit drinking. I knew that. I wanted to stop anything else, the pills and that, but I didn't want to stop drinking. And so I came in through another 12-step fellowship. And I remember I went there and, you know, thank God I didn't know at the time that you couldn't drink in this fellowship either, because I just thought I could carry on drinking and everything would be fine. And I remember they said they don't drink. And I'm like outside asking people, I can't have wine with my dinner. And they're like, no, just keep coming back. And yeah, I never drank wine with my dinner because I didn't eat and drink. That didn't happen. And I remember thinking, oh, I can't drink at my, you know, my daughter's wedding and all those things. And I mean, she was 9. But, you know, I was like projecting. Because I knew when you said it was a day at a time, I knew you were lying to me, because my mom and dad hadn't drank for years by this time. So anyway, I continued going to that fellowship. I truly don't think I didn't want to stop drinking, but I knew I had to. And after I was in there for a while, I was invited to a wedding. And it was actually, it's funny, because we passed Keswick, and I said that was my last drunk, was in there. And it was a big, big fancy reception. It was my sister-in-law's wedding. And I hadn't been drinking. I was feeling good, and I'd cleaned up the outside, and, you know, and people, you know, my husband at that time was starting to, respect me somewhat and trust me maybe a little. And I got there, and I had no intention of drinking. And I remember I seen my sister-in-law's drinking, and they're crazy. And I'm thinking, and the first thought was, if they can drink, I mean, why can't I? And so I manipulated a wine spritzer, because I figured, like, you know, wine and soda water, it would be fine. I had no intention of drinking, I'm sorry, and I passed a tray of wine, and I grabbed one, and, you know, I don't know why I done it. It was like just that I had got the little resentments during the day about them. I'm in the bathroom, and I remember crying, because I didn't want to do it, because I knew, I did know I was screwing up. And I threw it back, and it's funny, because that was when my surrender came, after that weekend, because I realized the first drink gets you drunk, because it wasn't like that one glass of wine got me drunk, it didn't, but my thinking totally changed immediately. All I could think about for the rest of that night, I didn't have any more, but all I could think of was, how can I drink at the wedding tomorrow? And that's when I went home and had the conversation of, you know, wine spritzers, I could probably drink them because they're diluted, and he doesn't know. He's like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, I'll be fine. And by that night, I had stole a bottle of Glenlivet whiskey out of the pantry and shared a fifth step with anyone that wanted to listen in the hotel. All the stuff I'd kept secret for years, you know, I just, because this was wonderful, and I was going back on Monday, you know. It was like, you know, I was on the weekend off, and I was going back, and, you know, thank God I did go back. And I hit that, I seen that I was powerless over alcohol, because until that time, I don't really think I believed that. I really thought I had a choice. So after that, you know, I came in, got a sponsor, and I was still in this other fellowship. And today, you know, I know that that wasn't the place for me. I'm an alcoholic. I was confused in the fact that my mom and dad were alcoholics and they weren't like me. You know, that's just all those things in my head. I was young. I wasn't like these old men I grew up around, and of course I didn't know like all these people were in these rooms. So I continued going to this 12-step fellowship and done everything that was suggested, the sponsorship, working the steps, not out the big book, service, all the things, meetings every single day, and it kept me sober, but I didn't get well. You know, it did not cure the spiritual malady, you know, the spiritual part of my disease. But it kept me sober long enough to find these rooms, and I'm really grateful for that. And when I came in here, it was like I'd hit a bottom in recovery, which was so painful, more painful than any bottom outside, because I don't have anything to numb it with. And it's to the point I'm just hating me, you know. It's like before I used to just hate all you, but now I'm hating me, and I just can't live, you know. I knew that I didn't want to drink because I knew where that was going to take me, but also knew I didn't want to live like this anymore. And by that point, I must admit, I had got all the material things, because the first year, kind of backtracking, but the first year in the program, I pretty much lost everything. I lost custody of my kids, and one of them actually went back to Scotland, and I didn't see her for nearly 2 years. The other one, my ex, pretty much got custody through fear and my ignorance. You know, I can see that today, but at the time, you know, he would let me see her every second weekend, and I'd been, even though, you know, I wasn't present, I was there with my kids 24/7 the last few years of my drinking. So that was really hard, and, you know, I'd never taken care of myself, supported myself in my life, and I'm in this country, and, you know, I've never worked here. And what I see today is my higher power. When I was willing to do the right next thing, everything just fell into place, and I can see that today. It was like I had went to college for a short time when I first moved here, and I sent a resume to this office, and one of the girls who I hadn't seen for years worked in this office, remembered my name, and I got a job immediately. First interview, had never worked in an office, but I got this job. But this time I had no credit. I'd screwed up my credit, and one of the girls took me in, and we shared an apartment. So the first, you know, it was really hard when I look back in hindsight, and I see, you know, losing my kids, the house, the car, all those things. But what I know today is all that was built on lies, manipulation. I wasn't a good mother. I wasn't a good wife, you know, I wasn't any of these things. And so pretty much for the first year and a half, all I had to concentrate was my recovery, because that's all I had. And I didn't have to change people, places, and things. I didn't have any of that when I came in here. I had no one. Even my in-laws by this time didn't want me around. I mean, I was just, you know, I was an embarrassment when I did go over there. So I really didn't have anything. So when I came in here, it was like, it was kind of awesome to find people, like people back in Scotland, because you're just, you know, a bunch of drunks, and, you know, that's what I was used to. So, first couple of years, that's all I had was my recovery, and I thank God for that today, because it meant that I had no distractions, basically. Then, as I said, as time went on, I got all these things back, you know, nice house, the really good job, you know, it's just like, everything just kind of fell into place. And then I kind of got busy for recovery, because I had all these things and my life got, you know, really busy. And I was getting the resentments and that were coming in. And, you know, I just was doing the bare minimum to get by. And thank God I was always taught that your home group, you showed up for that no matter what. Because for a while, that's all I ever done, was show up at my home group. Kept my service positions, but my attitude was, no one else can do it as good as me. So that's kind of why I done that. But, you know, thank God, because then I hit that bottom. And I knew I had to do something different. And it basically ran 4 years. You know, it crashed. And I had to come back and be new. And that's what I done. You know, I was new all over again. And this time around, you know, I got a sponsor who took me through the big book, done the steps the way they're outlined in the book, service, home group, sponsorship, all those things that suggested, so all the things I'd done the next time around, commitments, going to my meetings, showing up when I'm asked to show up, I don't know, just before, like, the woman in my life, you know, I liked you, but I wasn't getting too close to you. And today, it's like the woman I have in my life is just awesome, the huge group of women. So basically, when I came in, started all over again, and was really grateful that I didn't have to drink in order to do that, because, I mean, it was definitely at that point where only the grace of God kept me sober. I grew up, not that it matters what denomination, but for me, church was really important growing up when I was young. That was my outlet where I went when things were bad at home. I'd go to church, nobody had to ask me to go. But some of the things I had done when I was out there, the shame and the guilt, you know, and I actually shared a fifth step with a priest too, and that's what I needed to do for me. And once I was able to let go of some of that self-hatred, you know, my life definitely got better. For a long time, I think, you know, I was my own worst enemy. I just couldn't get the relief I needed in order to move on in this program, and I think that's what stopped me for a long time, and I was so consumed with self. And, you know, as times went on in the program, I mean, my life has been anything but smooth. I mean, I think I've went through a whole lot more changes and losses and different stuff since I got sober than I ever did when I was out there. And it's funny because when you're going through it, you know, the thing is, you kind of get told that you'll be able to help some other poor drunk down the line. And, of course, that's not what you want to hear when you're going through it, you know. But it's been the truth for me. It's like every experience I've had, whether it be my kids, losing my kids, divorce, losing houses, cars, I mean, the whole nine yards, it's like someone, I've been able to pass that one to someone else as times went on. And there's always been someone who's went through my experience too, and I mean, that's the awesome thing about this program. Today, I have an awesome life. I mean, it's like when I came in here, and I remember being told that you were to write down your wildest dreams, you'd be selling yourself short. And, you know, for me, when I came in, I just wanted to stop hurting. I didn't really want to stop drinking, but I wanted to stop hurting. I had no ambitions or goals or anything else. I mean, I didn't come in with all this big list of stuff that I wanted. And today I have found a purpose in life. I think I was looking for, and I always bounced from one thing to the next. I never completed anything, no matter what it was. I never stuck and stayed. When it got hard, I moved on to the next thing. And in this last couple of years, I mean, my life has just been all about starting things, completing them. I sponsor a bunch of women, and it's awesome seeing them. The changes coming in them, that's been just an awesome experience. And anytime I've went through some rough stuff, the thing that helps me is working with other drunks. And it's, again, not what I want here. I remember a couple of years ago I was going through a really bad patch. It was an ended relationship. And I'd go to meetings hoping to hear something from me. And I think it was actually Al who, I went one night, it was speaking at a speaker's meeting, and basically, you know, what I heard was if I just turn around, work with other drunks and leave my stuff there, when I turn back, it's either going to be gone or it's not going to be that important anymore. And that was my experience, and God put in all these drunks in my life, you know, these new women. And I don't think there's even one still around from that time, but you know what, I'm still sober, you know, and so, I mean, that's totally been my experience, that's what helps me today. I'm not always willing, I'll be honest. I don't bounce out of bed in the morning, happy, joyous and free. It takes me a while in the morning to be happy, joyous and free. I have to start my day off, you know, with the prayer meditation, if it's just 15 minutes sitting there, remembering what my purpose is for that day, and going out there and doing the best I can. It's not always, you know, it's not always great, but it's a lot better than it was all these years ago, you know. And at night, just reflecting on my day, and, you know, I don't go to bed angry anymore. I can look the world in the eyes. I mean, basically, there may be a few amends out there still to be made, but for the most part, you know, I can look the world in the eyes today and look myself in the mirror, because that was a big thing for me. I couldn't even do that for a long time. And when I went back to Scotland this year, I was looking for amends, like if I missed anyone, I'm sure, in blackouts, because I was a blackout drunk, I probably owe some somewhere. But, you know, it was like I didn't even feel that way. It was like this was the first time I'd been back since I was sober. And I had taken care of it over the years. And a lot of my amends have been living amends. Especially to my kids. I mean, I'm a good mom today. I'm there for my kids. And being taught in this program about commitment and showing up, and that's what I've been able to do for my family and my friends. You know, if I say I'm going to be there, I'm going to be there. I might kick and scream on my way, but I'm going to be there, you know. And as I was saying about the list, I mean, today, my life is so full. When I came in here, I had no cell phone, didn't need it, didn't have anyone to call me. I had a daily planner, and there was not a damn thing in it. Today, it's like, you know, my daily planner's full. My cell phone rings off the hook. You know, my work phone rings. Just so many people. And, you know, that fear of people's gone. The fear of letting people in. Because before, I just thought I'd go to my grave with all this stuff. And I have no problem just blurting stuff out. I mean, I don't even think anymore. There's no secrets. I met a wonderful guy. I'm getting married in April. It's just been abundant, the things that I've been given in this program. That, you know, my higher power has been so good. I know it's, you know, I hear all those little cliches. It's like, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. All those little things kept me going. And there's nothing I'd rather be than a drunk today. I mean, there's nowhere else for me. This year went up to the World Convention with my mom and dad. So, I mean, we all got to go up there, and, I mean, that was really special. And when I went back this year, you know, it's like I spoke in Scotland, and, you know, all those old drunks who now have like 30-something years of sobriety are there, you know, and it was a wonderful experience. I know, I'm just very grateful. I'm just grateful for my life today, and if you're new, just keep coming back, because, I mean, it works, and it just gets better and better, and, you know, life's got its ups and downs. I mean, it always will, but it's just life, and today I handle it so much different. I could cause a fight in an empty room, I mean, by myself. And today, you know, I don't fight. I thought about that. I really don't argue. I don't fight. I'm just kind of peaceful. And that's God working in my life, because that's just not who I was. And again, Billy, thanks for asking me to speak. And I think I'm done.